You're listening to Midori Howe's first broadcast on the 20th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, it may be the worst migrant boat disaster yet. Upwards of 700 are feared dead as a Libyan vessel capsizes off Lampedusa, but they keep on coming.
I felt it was our moral duty to concentrate also on our responsibility as Europeans to prevent this kind of tragedies to happen again and again.
Officials from 28 countries, among them EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, rushed to Luxembourg today for emergency talks on the crisis. I'll discuss this divisive issue with my guests Mary Dajewski and Quentin Peel. Also ahead, the French Prime Minister unveils plans to clamp down on rising racism, but is legislating against hatred enough?
C'est un fait incontestable.
It's an undeniable fact. Racism, anti-Semitism, hatred towards Muslims, towards foreigners, homophobia is increasing. To be racist, anti-Semitic, xenophobic is to break the law.
And Queen Elizabeth II turns 89 tomorrow and shows no inclination of dethroning herself. Is Britain's monarchy trying to avoid thinking about what happens next? That's all coming up on today's edition of Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Chief Editorial Writer and Columnist for The Independent here in London, Mary Dajewski, and Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House, Quentin Peel. Welcome both back to Midori House. Yesterday saw one of the worst maritime disasters to have occurred in European waters since the end of World War II. It is unlikely, however, that the name of the vessel or the names of any of the 700 or more victims will be much remembered. Those lost in this catastrophe are a fraction of the toll claimed by the Mediterranean over the last decade from a gathering refugee exodus from the North Africa and Middle East. At least 1,600 people have now drowned attempting the crossing this year alone. 13,500 were rescued just last week. Mary, first of all, that we know of, more than 218,000 people actually made the crossing last year. Where are they coming from and why, and what's the hurry?
They're coming from all sorts of different places. They converge from all over sub-Saharan Africa in Libya. Some of them are Libyans fleeing the violence in Libya, but a lot of them are not Libyans. They're coming from all other places and exploiting the fact that there's no authority in Libya that can actually stop the boats, which is what was happening before. So there's a huge number of people and a huge variety of people.
Quentin, this is, of course, it's a ghastly humanitarian catastrophe. The testimonies and the photography emerging from this latest disaster are hideous, as have all the previous iterations of the same event. It's also an incredibly difficult political problem, and the solution obviously has to be a political one, which is why we have ministers currently converging upon Luxembourg. From Europe's perspective, where is the balance between humanitarian decency and facilitating people smuggling?
Well, I think it's overwhelmingly, and the balance should be on the former and not on the latter, that there is above all a humanitarian disaster here, and that's got to be treated. But that is not politically very popular. And the reason why, in fact, the Europeans scaled back the extent to which they were trying to police the coastline and have substantial naval resources out there to try and pick up the boats, that was really last year when, led by Britain, most of the European Union simply refused to go on financing the Italians to do this. So we scaled back, and it's done absolutely nothing to discourage the people smugglers. So the argument was, by having all these patrols, we'll encourage the people smugglers. Well, we scaled back and they've gone on.
This is, of course, the scaling back from Italy's Mare Nostrum operation to the EU's smaller, as you point out, Operation Triton, which is currently trying to police the Mediterranean refugee exodus with 9 ships, 1 plane and 1 helicopter, which is obviously not nearly enough.
It's a farce.
Mary, as Quentin points out, the problem that politicians now face, all of whom are obliged to keep running for office, is that whatever their instincts may be, however noble their humanitarian instincts may be, spending money and time and energy on resources on refugees, especially on illegal immigrants, is just monstrously unpopular. In fact, more or less instant career death, isn't it, for any European politician?
Well, yes, it is. And I mean, one of the things that's really interesting is the practical silence out from anybody in the UK over the last 48 hours.
Yes, funny
other than platitudes. You know, with two weeks and a half to go before an election in this country, and everybody knows where the balance of public opinion would be. Now, I have to say, I admit with a slightly guilty conscience that I'm a lot harder hearted than Quentin is. I think there is a real problem here, and that it's all very well for the European foreign minister or the for Federica Mogherini to say, you know, all our European values and everything are at stake here, which is true. But you can't say that on the one hand and go out and rescue tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people, without at the same time taking responsibility for accommodating and resettling them. And that is something that Europe as a whole both will not and cannot physically do. It's not just a political thing. It is a practical thing. And there are going to be too many people to resettle. And they're going to be particularly difficult people to resettle because a lot of them have very little education. A lot of them have lived through wars and are damaged by that experience. I think it's going to be very difficult to find countries to take them. And once you've said that, the difference between saying, yes, it's a dreadful tragedy, we've got to do something, not being willing to do the one thing that these people have got into the boats for, which is to get into Europe, then you have a very, very sharp moral dilemma.
I'm freely willing to admit that I just don't know what to think about this. It is horrible. I've been to some of the countries these people are leaving and can well understand why they want to leave them. But I can also see the, as Mary points out, Quentin, it's one thing to fish drowning people out of the water. That's just what any basically civilized human being would be expected to do. The question is, and then what? What are our obligations to these people once we've hauled them ashore onto European territory?
Well, I totally agree. There are absolutely no easy answers. But one, we should have more resources to haul them out of the water. Two, we should share more the burden of looking after these people and not say it all belongs in Italy, it all belongs in Greece. Now, the Germans and the Swedes are doing a great deal to take in more people. The British are not. And it's a very clear distinction. There should be much more burden sharing. The problem, I think, here is that everybody's instinct with migration issues, border issues, is to try and deal with it in a national way. Put up your own borders, keep them out of your own territory. But this is absolutely clearly a European problem, and we've got to do it together. The third part of the exercise is the very long-term one, which is the one that the British government, for example, says, oh, that's what we're doing, is to try and tackle the problem at source, that's to say in Eritrea, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, in Sudan, of course in Syria.
And of course we did a great job of that by bombing Syria, but by bombing Libya and by creating a war in Iraq that wasn't there.
Well, Matteo Renzi has said exactly that, Quentin. He said that the focus should be on improving stability in conflict zones, which is a lovely idea and one with which nobody would disagree. But in terms of Libya, especially, which appears to be the major source of these people, he basically means, if he's serious, he means invading Libya.
He probably does. When we bombed Libya and bombed the horrible Colonel Gaddafi out of office, we actually took the cork out of the bottle. There were already in southern Libya then hundreds of thousands of refugees that Gaddafi's horrible regime was keeping back from coming to Europe. When we overthrew him and created chaos in the country, it just meant the floodgates were opened. So we have a very, very significant responsibility for the problem that has been caused, and therefore we cannot wash our hands of it.
On that front, Mary, when you look at what Matteo Renzi has said, and he said that the focus should be on improving stability. He hasn't actually said we should invade Libya. That was me sort of reading between the lines. But is there, if it's politically impossible to sell European electorates on the idea of accommodating more refugees, is it politically Is it politically sellable to a European electorate to say we have to go there and spend blood and treasure in order to actually try and sort these countries out? The trouble is, of course, what with one thing and another, selling anybody in the West on interventions in unstable Middle Eastern states, it's a tricky one.
Yes, well, I think it's going to be extremely difficult. I mean, it may be that the balance has slightly tipped, because what you're looking at now is the possibility of an almost infinite number of people getting in boats off the coast of Libya to come to Europe. And if the only way of trying to prevent that is direct intervention, then you might find more of an appetite for it than there's been simply for intervening in other people's countries, apparently sort of for the sake of it. So there might be a slight advantage there, but I think it's extremely difficult, because the British vote on not intervening in Syria, when the government basically lost the vote in Parliament 2 summers ago, that was actually emblematic of the arguments that were going on everywhere else. And the vote in the British Parliament was followed either by votes elsewhere or by decisions taken by governments to preempt votes that they knew they were going to lose.
Quentin, on the idea that we've discussed a bit about, you know, whether there's something in the idea that maybe actually taking a somewhat harder line is ultimately a more compassionate approach. If you discourage people from getting in the boats in the first place, fewer of them will drown, there will be less money for people smugglers, etc. People have mentioned the Australian example from time to time. Australia has a much smaller refugee problem than Europe currently does. It makes a much bigger thing of it domestically, politically, than even Europe does, in fact, to a frankly absurd degree. But Australia does do things like make it very, very clear that there is no path to resettlement in Australia if you arrive illegally. It resettles immigrants basically it bribes places like Papua New Guinea and Cambodia and Nauru to take them instead. And in a couple of cases, it has actually put refugees in more seaworthy vessels and sent them back in the direction from whence they came. Is there anything to be said for that approach?
No. I really think that was the argument, which is why we reduced all these patrols off the Italian coast and everything, that it just encourages them. And it has proved absolutely nothing to try and get... There clearly is a tremendous pent-up pressure here. But imagine what these people have gone through just to get to the Libyan coast. I mean, these people have come thousands of miles from their conflict zones, and young kids. So they are pretty desperate. And I just don't think it is an answer to say we will put up some sort of total naval blockade. I just don't think it'll work.
Mary, how much of a problem is the fact that, as well as being massively, for any politician who did decide to take a compassionate lead on this, or to even discuss terms of generosity or even understanding of their predicament in similar to the tones that Quentin just has. And he is, of course, right. These people have undergone things which are unimaginable to those of us fortunate enough to live somewhere like this. But how much of the problem is that, as well as being massively unpopular with domestic electorates, because of that, if you are a centrist liberal politician, as most European politicians are, if you speak up for these people, you are fueling the Front National or UKIP or their equivalent far-right populists all over Europe, aren't you?
I'm not completely convinced of that, because when it appeared that the Syrian refugee crisis was at its height, and there are hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees who are still in the region, in Lebanon and Jordan and places like that, when that was in discussion, interestingly, it was the British UKIP party in the shape of Nigel Farage, its leader, who said, Britain must take Syrian refugees. He made a very clear distinction between desperate people who were dispossessed and who'd got nowhere to go, like Syrian refugees, and, as it were, what he would probably call the economic migrants who are sitting in Calais waiting to stow away on a train or a boat to get to Britain, who he would probably call illegals who should be sent back. So I think there is a distinction in a lot of people's minds between refugees who we owe to resettle somewhere and somehow, and illegal migrants who break the rules to get there. And I think there's another distinction too, which is that there are these thousands and thousands of Syrian refugees in camps all over the Middle East. And there is a resettlement program in which the British have been particularly ungenerous. Now, what we're looking at here, and some people would say, well, the people who are coming from North Africa and getting in boats and are being accepted in Italy and able then to move through Europe, they are actually jumping the queue, and meaning that it's much more difficult to have an orderly resettlement program for refugees who are playing it by the rules and sitting in camps in the Middle East.
Quentin, we have heard some fine talk from some European leaders over the last couple of days. François Hollande has said that Europe needs more boats, more aerial surveillance and a much tougher fight against traffickers. And Mariano Rajoy in Spain has told supporters that words won't do anymore. Are we likely to see such sentiments actually amounting to anything practical in the near future?
I think we are going to see some action. I'm just not quite sure how much. And I'm not sure whether, okay, there may be a few more patrol boats. Is there going to be more burden sharing of the burden that's come, that we face? I think that all remains to be seen. So I'm particularly depressed. I think it's come out very clearly from our discussion that actually the contribution of the British government has been really very about as feeble as anybody's contribution. And that's very sad. I think there's a serious lack of what I would call genuine political leadership here to recognise that we are in a world of increasing migration. And we've got to cope with that. We cannot cope with it by pulling up the drawbridge. We've got to cope with it by actually doing far more, both to integrate people, but to train our own people, so that there isn't this left-behind group in our own countries who resent immigration. We need much braver political leadership here.
Mary, on the front of political leadership, I was wondering what you think the tone, what difference to this discussion does the tone of political discourse make? Because it is incredibly emotive, understandably so. These are, you know, tremendous stakes being played here. But does the emotive talk actually help us? Because you tend to end up with people who just want to be seen to be taking a stand either for the immigrants or against the immigrants, none of which appears to actually lead us towards a practical solution. Should it be maybe in terms of thinking of a solution, it shouldn't be thought of as a human problem? Is that clouding judgment on both sides?
I don't know. I mean, I wish that for everybody who said this is a colossal human tragedy, we've got to do something, would then say exactly how they propose to do it and what money they propose to earmark and where they propose to resettle the people who are coming over, hoping against hope to remain in Europe. And the trouble at the moment is we have the first bit and we don't have the second bit. And until we have the second bit, in whatever form, whether it's better patrols of the coast or whether it's proper resettlement program, until you have that, all the fine words about compassion and European values and everything are really as nothing.
Well, earlier today, three people died when a migrant boat ran aground on Rhodes. Italian and Maltese ships were reported to be responding to distress signals from two further migrant boats. We will be coming back to this one, unfortunately. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dujewski and Quentin Peel. When we return, we will look at France's new approach to what it thinks is a rising tide of racism.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink program, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And you are welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with my studio guests Mary Dajewski and Quentin Peel. Let's look now at France, a country which has traditionally dealt with tensions between its various communities by pretending that its community doesn't vary. The French census disdains to count citizens by race, religion or ethnicity. However, January's Islamist terror attacks at the offices of Charlie Hebdo and a kosher supermarket made the point that problems are rarely solved by ignoring them. France's response, unveiled over the weekend, is a €100 million, 3-year plan to confront racism and hate speech. Quentin, the Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, has said that racism, anti-Semitism, hatred of Muslims, hatred of foreigners and homophobia are all rising in an unbearable way in our country, which is not a line that will be appearing on the tourist posters. Is he right?
I think there has been a very clear increase in anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic slogans, attacks on graveyards. I think the other way round, I think that there is an Islamophobia that has built up as well. So I think it's bad. I'm not sure. I mean, an unbearable pressure. I think you've got to have a very careful balancing act here between, yes, saying we will not tolerate race hatred, racist speech and so on, and realizing that you cannot actually ultimately legislate against people being prejudiced.
Well, this is my thought exactly, and it's initiatives like this. I remember with a shudder the Blair government's attempt to bring in a law again out what was it, incitement to religious hatred or something equally preposterous. It does bring out the cranky free speech libertarian in me. Mary, the same question, I guess, is there any point in trying to pass laws about what people can say and, more to the point, what they can think?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, because it is very, very difficult. And in the very act of legislating, you're limiting something which until then was sort of free and undefined. Having said that, I do think I was based in Paris in the mid-late 90s, and I do think that the atmosphere between ethnic groups was more tense than it was in Britain at the time and has been in Britain since. And I think that one of the things that generally Britain has done quite well, and whether it's because of laws or whether it's because of all sorts of other things, is that there is a greater mixing of ethnic groups and a greater acceptance. And you see people doing jobs in Britain, black, brown, people with veils, people, all sorts of different people. And in France, at least until very recently, you didn't see that. So I do think there's a distinction. And there's a distinction too in the way that a lot of the minorities in France are de facto segregated by living in the banlieues on the edge of big cities. And this is something that's sort of grown up, everybody knew about it. And finally, it seems that both in the housing aspect and in the cultural aspect, that France is maybe wanting to tackle it. But it's quite late in the day and it'll be very difficult to do.
Laws like this or initiative like this do strike me, at least, as an extremely poor memorial to the staff of Charlie Hebdo and everything for which they stood. A new unit that they're going to announce, it says here, is going to monitor online hatred. Now, Quentin, this strikes me as either or both a massive waste of everybody's time or an excuse to extend surveillance.
It's certainly like trying to put your finger in the dike, I think, given what you've got online. You have got to try. I mean, I actually think an education, there's lots of stuff in here which is about better education, better schooling, trying to get, you know, so it's not all about just trying to legislate it out of existence. And I think that is probably positive. I think that Mary puts her finger on another very good point, which is this mistaken French policy, if you like, of banishing the minorities to the edge of cities rather than integrating them more in the middle. We all have big problems. I mean, go back to our former discussion. We are in a world of migration. Mm-hmm. This is unstoppable. And we've got to therefore come up with policies like this, which are going to help us all come to terms with it better. So, I think no policy is not an answer. I mean, I hear your libertarianism, but actually I also believe that outright insulting behaviour, outright racial hatred, there should be a line. You've got to be able to draw a line somewhere.
Just very, very carefully. Finally today, Queen Elizabeth II turns 89 tomorrow. Happy birthday, the Queen. She is the oldest reigning monarch in the world and the second oldest head of state. Anyone outranked only by...
Yes, Mugabe.
Correct, Robert Mugabe. And it is perhaps this latter example which prompts discussion, which grows a little louder around this time every year, of whether or not she should hand in her crown. And it is usually consideration of the recipient that silences it again for another 12 months. Mary, there's no chance she'd go, is there?
Well, I don't think there is, but I think there's a very specific reason for that. As we've watched the crowned heads of almost every other European country that has a monarchy in recent years hand over to the next generation, it's been pretty clear that this isn't going to happen in Britain. And the reason is the abdication crisis. The way that the Queen actually became the successor to the throne.
Well, indeed so. She's been there so long, it's kind of forgotten that it wasn't supposed to happen.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, what I've seen written and commented is that when the Queen ascended to the throne, that she made a vow to herself that she wouldn't inflict a new abdication crisis or other crisis, that she would serve for her life. And I think she's determined to do that. I mean, we can see that she's handed over various of her powers and various of her functions. She does much less travelling than she used to. She presides at many fewer formal events. But it looks as though she's intent on serving out her days.
Quentin, the impression I get is that the palace is probably pretty confident about the next generation, but the next one. But how nervous are the powers that be likely to be about what happens next?
I went to see the play Charles III the other day, and I actually enjoyed it very much. I must say this, I was born the same year that Prince Charles was born, and I'm rather a fan. I think he'd be great fun in power. I think he'd at least give character to a rather dull office, and I think there's no harm. If he actually speeds up the process of us becoming a republic, I'm not sure I'm that offended by that either. But guess what? The Queen's got a real problem about to land in her 89-year-old plate, and that is that we're going to have a completely hung parliament in Britain after the elections that are coming up. And somehow she may have to decide that the person who becomes prime minister is not the one who leads the largest party or something else. It's going to be a very tough decision.
It is going to be a tough decision, one of many she faces, as Quentin points out. Is there any reason, I guess, not to dread the accession of Charles? I confess to being not quite as much a fan as Quentin.
Well, I'm one of the people who is waiting with bated breath to see the contents of what I think are called his spider writing letters, because he spent some time writing to make his views known on various subjects to ministers and members of Parliament. And the Supreme Court in the UK decided a few weeks ago that these letters were not covered by confidentiality or privacy provisions and that they should be made public. Now, they haven't been made public yet, but when they are, as I imagine they will be, we might get some sort of insight into what sort of a monarch Charles might be when he takes over.
I really hope we discover when those letters are released that they were all written in their original instance in green ink. anybody who's ever worked for a newspaper in the pre-email model will understand what I mean by that. We will have to leave it there. Quentin Peel and Mary Dejewski, thank you very much for joining me here at Midori House. That is all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mikey Wynn. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Monocle's international playlist continues next. Then at 1900 hours, you have Rob Bound with The Culture Show. At 2200, The Monocle Daily is back with me and Georgina Godwin. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time or any time you like after that on our website. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.